A couple of very interesting situations. And largely, you have one who is a prominent leader who falls and another prominent leader who stands. And the contrast between chapter 38 and 39 of Genesis is astounding. We look at 38, it's almost as a parenthesis. We started the life of Joseph and we left off with him being sold as a slave by his brothers. But the story takes a little break here now, and chapter 38 focuses on the flaws of his older brother, Judah, who was, in a sense, the ringleader of why Joseph was taken as a slave. He thought he was pretty brilliant in saving Joseph's life by saying, hey, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites as they're coming through so we don't have blood on our hands. And I think shortly after that, usually in the passion of a moment, you think you're doing the right thing, and then afterwards you realize, what was I thinking? And I'm sure that Judah must have had that sort of thing. Now the story kind of follows Judah a little bit, and then it'll come back to Joseph. What I see in both of these lives, both Judah and his stumbling, and Joseph in his exemplary trust of God in the midst of the most dire circumstances, is two pictures of the sovereignty of God at work. You see, God is going to do his plan. He's got a purpose for Judah and the lineage eventually who will be in the ancestry of the Messiah, through whom will come Jesus, an amazing genealogy following right on down through Judah. So God has a plan for Judah. But I think if you'd asked Judah, after he stumbles horribly with this sexual sin and other areas where he stumbles, was it worth it? Well, you see, God is going to use him despite him. But you see, the difference is Judah does not get to enjoy that usefulness. He's the one that's shamed as a result. Now, Joseph, on the other hand, he hits it hard. He gets hit. He is struck. The Bible kind of used the picture of the arrows, the archers struck him and hurt him deeply and wounded him in fetters. Yet he stood strong in the midst of it. And God's sovereignty is going to work by raising him up and exalting him. So Judah, in a sense, exalts himself and is humbled. And Joseph is humbled, but God raises him up. And this is how, in many ways, our lives work as well. The humble are exalted and the proud are humbled. And we learn this lesson, but more than anything, I think we can learn some practical things for our own lives. Let's jump into Genesis chapter 38, verse 1. It came to pass at the time that Judah departed from his brothers. So at the time that Joseph was sold, Judah departs and visits a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah there saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he married her and went into her. So right now, very quickly, Judah, probably weighed down by the guilt of his actions, he needs to get away, clear his head. But instead of really seeking the Lord, he kind of goes down to the area of the Canaanites, only about 8 miles away, but just the mistake that Jacob made earlier when his family lived a little too closely to the world. And those are the things that we can be as well affected by. And certainly being there, he happens to see a certain Canaanite whose daughter is, well, she's beautiful, I'm sure. And so he marries her, thinking perhaps, hey, you know, maybe I can influence her to follow Jehovah. But as you see the story unfold, it doesn't really turn out that way. It says she conceived and bore a son. He called his name Ur, and she conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan, and she conceived again and bore a son and called his name Shelah. And he was at Chezeb when she bore him. So now he's moving deeper into the Canaanite culture. And you're going to see that God ultimately is going to reject these sons as being the heirs, because he has made decisions that affect the Lord's ultimate plan for him. He's going to see some painful repercussions of those decisions. Marrying the Canaanite, I am certain, and you look at these sons, you're going to see that they were greatly influenced by their mother as opposed to their father. It says that Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, verse 6, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. Wow, what a way to go. It's like that. You're out of here. Now, of course, the Bible doesn't go into details. What was it that he did that was so wicked that God found it necessary to remove him from the earth? We're not told. Then the next son, Judah, said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother. But Onan knew that the heir would not be his. And it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, therefore he killed him also. Not a great start, Judah, for the next lineage to pass on down the Messiah. You see, here's what's interesting. The custom of the next youngest brother to marry his brother's wife was a custom called the levirate marriage or the liveret marriage from the Latin word lever, which means brother-in-law. It was a custom that was later codified in the law of Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 25, that this would come down. In fact, later on, the Sadducees literally are making fun of Jesus by this question when they try to follow this lineage and they say, hey, a certain man got married to a woman and he died, and the brother of that man married the woman and he died, and the next brother married and he died, and all seven of them married her and they all died. So whose will she be in the resurrection? Who will she be married to? And of course, Jesus said something very interesting in his answer. He said, you err in not knowing the power of God nor the scriptures. Interesting, those are the two biggest mistakes we make in our lives. Jesus pointed it out right there. We err. We make big mistakes by, number one, not knowing the power of God, and two, not knowing the scriptures. Now, it's interesting because Jesus uses this picture and he says later, hey, they're not going to marry in the resurrection. But they were referring to this levirate kind of a setup. Later in the book of Ruth, it's all revolved around that story, where Ruth finds the nearest kin, Boaz, who does the job of the kinsman redeemer, who steps in and marries her and raises up an heir so that that lineage would go on. And of course, she is in the ancestry of the Messiah as well. Well, here we have these two sons that have totally blown it. Now, the interesting thing is what church traditions have made out of this situation with Onan. He does not finish. He doesn't consummate. And the reason is, we're told, because he does not honor this custom. In fact, in the Canaanite culture, it wouldn't be uncommon that you have your wife or your children, but you have all your other options. You've got the temple prostitutes. The Canaanite culture was just steeped in sexual practices. So you really didn't have to find your pleasure there. But here he finds his pleasure with her, but then he still backs out and doesn't consummate the marriage so that she can actually have a child. Almost as if to say, thumbing his nose up in front of God saying, I'm not going to raise up an heir that will be following in the lineage of my brother, who Judah wants him to be the heir of this Jehovah God's plan. And so the Lord dealt with him. Sadly, this Onanism, as it's been called, has been misapplied to any use of contraception, which is not the point. And some even have gone so far as to say any sexual pleasure without the intention of having children is applied here. And those views are extreme, certainly not biblical, because really the point is he was simply not wanting to acknowledge or honor God. So the Lord removes him. So now here's where Judah makes his second biggest mistake. First, marrying a Canaanite. You know, are you not aware of how influential someone that close to your life will be? And so often people marry someone that does not have the same relationship with the Lord, the same belief. And instead of influencing them, they slip back. And this is what I believe happens to Judah. Now he falters. Verse 11, it says, Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, well, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. So in other words, he's promising Shelah, they're betrothed, if you will, from this point on, according to this word. But listen to what he's really thinking. For he said, lest he also die like his brothers. You know, man, this woman is bad luck. Two of my sons are killed. And of course, he doesn't realize it was the Lord's doing. He's a little out of touch. Well, Tamar went and dwelt with her father's house. Now, I don't think she was none too happy to go back into the Canaanite family, because you're going to find something out about Tamar. Though she has an unorthodox approach, her ultimate intentions are to be married in this family and raise up an heir that will be, you know, according to the lineage of Judah and honor the God of Judah. So this is what her heart is, though she does it, well, a little questionably. in the process of time, it says the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. So his wife dies. Now, it's funny, we're never told her name. She's just the daughter of Shua. And Judah was comforted and went up to the sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And it was told Tamar, he's through the grieving process of his wife dying. She's told, hey, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear sheep. And she does something really wild. She takes off her widow's garments, covers herself with a veil, wraps herself, and sat in an open place which was on the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown and she was not given to him as a wife. So now you see she understands that the real motive for Judah saying, well, go wait until he grows up, because presumably he was a little young at that time, but she sees now he's not fulfilling what he promised. He's grown, nothing's happening, and here's where the story really gets interesting. Tamar, though technically betrothed to Shelah, realizes that it's not happening, so she poses as a temple prostitute. Where's the veil? Which actually in the Canaanite culture, believe it or not, was an honorable profession. They were set apart for their gods. But her motive was not lust, nor was it money. She wants to do one thing. She wants Judah to go into her so that they will have a child, and then he will be forced to marry her. This is what her ultimate plan is, and you're going to see this. The biblical record, believe it or not, does not condemn Tamar. In fact, it actually puts her in the genealogy of the Messiah in Matthew chapter 1. She's one of the four women who are mentioned. Later we'll see they have something in common, all these women. Well, when Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot because she had covered her face. And he turned to her by the way. Again, he's without his wife, and now here his third sin. Now he's going into a prostitute that he thinks is. He says, please let me come into you, for he didn't know that it was his daughter-in-law. So she said, what will you give me that you may come into me? And he says, well, I'll send a young goat from the flock. And so she said, well, what will you give me as a pledge till you send it? He says, well, what pledge shall I give you? And she asks for some personal effects, your signet and cord, things that would have only meant anything to him, and your staff that's in your hand. Not really valuable things, but something that was meaningful to him. And so he gave them to her, went into her, and she conceived by him. So then he arose and went away, and she laid aside her veil and put on the garments of her widowhood. She now gets back, and she's not going to be a prostitute. She was only planning this to strategize to get pregnant by him so that he would be forced to marry her. Now, interestingly enough, Ruth does something similar but not as provocative. She's counseled by Naomi to go to Boaz and present herself as one that essentially proposed to him by going there at night, uncovering his feet so he'll wake up, and then he'll perform the duty of a kinsman redeemer. Boaz, however, was an honorable man and didn't take advantage of her that night, but he could have. Instead, he went through the right process to legally obtain her as a wife, and the two were married. Tamar takes matters into her hands a little bit too much. Nonetheless, ultimately what happens? Judah then, verse 20 through verse 23 essentially shows that he's trying to send the goat to her and can't find her. Ask the men, where is this harlot? There's no harlot here. Never has been one. And so Judah just says, well, unless I'm embarrassed, I'm just going to let her just leave. And so he just quickly forgets about it and goes away. But at verse 24, picking up the story, it came to pass about 3 months after Judah was told, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law has played the harlot. Furthermore, she's with child by harlotry. So Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. You know what amazes me about the hypocrisy here? Judah, he's married a Canaanite. He's had no influence on his sons. He's not walking with the Lord, apparently. He sinned with Tamar by not giving Shelah, his son, to her. And now he sinned by going into a prostitute. And of course, well, you got to burn her. Amazes me, the hypocrisy. But you know, the funny thing is, there is a principle here that I think all of us can apply to our own lives. Listen, the bottom line is, the very basic truth is this. Our sin always looks much worse on somebody else, doesn't it? Would to God that we would have a more honest look at ourselves. And I love actually the Bible and its honesty. This chapter has actually been a chapter that some Bible commentaries have said there's no redeeming value to find any message in this. You know, they would even refrain pastors from teaching or even going through this chapter because it just seems so abhorrent to our culture. And well, it should. You can see Judah is just so steeped in Canaanite culture now, and now he wants to burn her. So notice she comes out. She said to her father-in-law, saying, "Well, by the man to whom these belong, I'm with child." You recognize them? I'm a little paraphrase there. "Please determine whose these are, the signet, the cord, and the staff. Do they look familiar, Judah?" So Judah acknowledged them and said, "She has been more righteous than I, because I did not give to her Shelah, my son." And he never knew her again. But listen, by the very fact that he acknowledges this, he's required to take her in, and the twins that she bears will be in his lineage now. Judah was unfaithful. God rejects his seed through the Canaanite woman, but allows Tamar, though unconventional, to bring forth an heir that when we finally get to see God's hand in this, we're going to see this pregnancy is going to result in the birth of twins. Verse 27 through verse 30 essentially shows the twins were born. One stuck his hand out first and they put a scarlet cord around him, and then he pulled his hand back in, and then the other one came out first and they named him Perez, because you've breached your brother. You've overcome him. There's a wrestling in the womb. It seems like in many ways the Lord shows his pleasure by choosing the weak things of the world. Now what's especially important to remember is that, remember the generations of Esau? In chapter 36, we saw Esau's genealogy. This is the generations of Esau. And it was kings and chiefs and mighty men and this huge 43 verses of, you know, these descendants. And then we saw the generations of Jacob, Joseph, and now Judah. Interesting, Joseph, a 17-year-old kid that's sold as a slave. And Judah, a man who's going into a prostitute, having already blown it by marrying a Canaanite. Do you see something interesting here? Do you see a pattern? The Lord is not interested in the strength, in the ability, in the power of people. He wants to show his power, and in many ways it's through the weakness of people that God has ordained his plan to unfold. It's not until later we discover Ruth, when she bears her child by Boaz, who is the grandfather of David. Ruth turns out to be the great-grandmother of King David. But there's an interesting blessing that's given Ruth in the book of Ruth. She said, "May your descendants be like Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." An interesting, odd blessing that they would actually invoke this as a blessing, because it seems to us in our culture kind of a sordid story of her going out and acting like that. But she was actually thinking in terms of the heir. And she stood in the gap, and then he married her, and of course it was all right. Interesting thing is there's some parallels with these women. As Tamar's mentioned in the genealogy in Matthew of Jesus, so is Ruth. There's two other women, and they all have something in common, a couple things in common. They're all non-Jews. Ruth was a Moabitess. Tamar was a Canaanite. Rahab, also mentioned, was a Canaanite from Jericho. And Bathsheba, who was the wife of Uriah the Hittite, was presumably a Hittite herself. All of them were non-Jews. And then each of them also came into the family of Judah by, well, what you'd say, morally questionable means. Tamar posed as a prostitute. Rahab was a prostitute. Ruth persuaded Boaz to marry her by a questionable thing. And then Bathsheba became the wife of David by adultery. You know what strikes me about this? It's interesting to me that God shows us Judah's failure here, and yet God is faithful. But it also shows to me, this is proof to me in many ways. Now, there are many reasons why I believe the Bible is God's word, and I have no problem with every word coming from God, and anyone who tells you differently has something to sell you, believe me. Because often what you have is that when people say, "Well, I believe the Bible contains the word of God," then you're going to have to depend on them, the experts, to tell you what parts you can trust. No, thank you. You see, I can actually trust God preserved his word. I can tell you, man even if he could have written the Bible, which he couldn't have, because you've got accuracy in history, you've got scientific statements that gel with our modern understanding today, that most religious books of ancient origin have some of the silliest things in them. Bible, not so. Can't find any one silly scientific fact. You also have amazing prophecy, which is unique. It's God's signature on the Bible. But one of the most amazing features to me is the honesty of the Bible. If man were trying to prove to you, and they had this conspiracy to try to sell you that Jesus was the Messiah, do you think for a moment they would put these four women in the genealogy that all have non-Jewish descent and have questionable moral behavior? Of course not. People today, when they find their own genealogy, they like to kind of, you know, soften some of the history. You know, you find a bad egg in your ancestry, you usually don't advertise it, do you? Here the Bible just puts it out there. Kind of reminds me of the Taylors, who were very proud of their family tradition and history. Their ancestors, after all, were tracing back to the Pilgrims on the Mayflower, and they had congressmen and sports stars and television stars and entrepreneurs that were famous in their lineage, and they wanted to do a more thorough genealogical study. They hired somebody, a specialist, to help them write it. Only one problem. They had this great Uncle George Taylor who was executed in the electric chair. He was a scoundrel, and he was executed by the state. They didn't know what to do with him. It's embarrassing, a little spot on their genealogy. Well, the writer said he could handle the story tactfully just to trust him. So when the book finally came out, this is how it read. Great Uncle George Taylor occupied a chair of applied electronics and an important government institution. He was attached to his position by the strongest of ties, and his death came as a great shock. Now that's spicing it up a little bit. But you know, the Bible doesn't do that. It just lets you see it, it lets it all hang out. This is what these men were. Yet despite them, God is going to do his will. Now, lest anyone would think, well, you know, since God is sovereign, what does it matter what I do? Who cares? God is going to fulfill his word. It doesn't matter how I live, right? Now, there was almost a Gnostic doctrine back in the first century, or toward the second century, third century AD, when the Gnostics kind of believed that whatever you did with your body didn't really matter because it was your soul that mattered. And so there was two sects of Gnostics, some who tried to discipline the body because they thought the body was evil, and others thought, well, the body was irrelevant, so you could live however you wanted and it wouldn't affect your soul. There are people today that actually adopt that kind of philosophy. Well, God is going to, you know, fade, and he's going to work his plan out anyway. It doesn't matter what I do. Ultimately, in a way, God is going to work his plan out, despite you. The question is, do you want to be like Judah, who had to live with his shame for the rest of his life? Who never really amounted to much anything personally himself, though God raised up his lineage to eventually be the lineage through whom the Messiah would come. Now you contrast this with Joseph. In chapter 39, we come back to the story of Joseph. Remember, we left him having been sold as a slave by his own brothers. We saw how many ways there were about 15 parallels of Jesus in that one chapter, chapter 37. And in chapter 39, there's another 11 more parallels of how his life is a type of Jesus and in many ways a model for us. The secret of Joseph is seen in this chapter, however. A phrase that's repeated four times gives us a clue as to why Joseph was so successful despite all the pains and problems that he faced. A simple little statement we're going to see. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. See, down to Egypt, down there. You'll always see Egypt in reference to going down. It's a literary picture as well as a geographical one. But verse 2 gives us that phrase, the Lord was with Joseph. Seems infuriating in a way to us in our looking at what happened to him. If God is with him, why is he allowing this? Why is he being sold as a slave? Why is he now a slave in this officer's house? And why? And throughout this chapter, we'll see even more things happen to Joseph. But the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now, he's a slave. You know, they had in that culture, of course, slavery. Slavery has been passed down through many cultures. Sadly, slavery is not gone away in the world. In many of the radical Islamic regimes in which they're, especially in Sudan, I mean, literally, there are stories that they'll make raids on a people, Christians particularly, a Christian village, and they'll kill the men, they'll take the women and the boys and the children, and they'll take them and they'll basically turn them into slaves. There was a story of one man that actually escaped and eventually had his story in a book and presented it to Congress to let them know this is still going on. I think of Black History Month. I want to remind you to go to wallbuilders.com and just click on the little thing about Black history. You will be amazed at some of the amazing stories of the Christian people that had the Black Christians who went through the most horrible experiences, yet God used them in an amazing way. I read a story about Robert Smalls, who was a strong Christian, who was a slave, and he had learned how to steer the steamships, and they eventually used him. They forced him to look over this one particular ship, which was called the Planter. And, he had plotted a way after the officers went off, he had plotted a way to get the families of all the crew, who were all kind of slaves there and captive, to get their families on board. And then they took off. And he was able to successfully navigate through all of the different waters, hostile enemies, to get back, and eventually was raised up as one of the captains, and was the first one that was enlisted as an officer who was Black in the army. Just an amazing story of a guy who was so faithful and brilliant. And I think of Joseph, like, here he is, taken, he's a slave, but listen, he's going to be the best slave he can be, because you see, he's not doing his work for Potiphar. And it's a great lesson for all of us. Whoever you work for, you're really not working for them. You're under the employment of Jesus Christ if you're a believer. You're doing your work, the Bible says, and you should do your work heartily as unto the Lord. That's annoying to me as a pastor to hear reports of Christian businessmen. They don't even want to hire Christians sometimes, because the Christians take advantage of the situation. You know, they come in late, oh, we're brothers, Shut up. What are you thinking? You're not working for that person. You're working for the Lord. You should be the best employee. You should be the hardest worker. You should be doing it with a great attitude, hard work, unto the Lord. And you know what? This is the secret. I believe because Joseph, wherever he was, see, it didn't matter what circumstance. This is what stands out in him, his life. Whatever happened to him, he turned it to the Lord and he did his best. And he was successful. And it says, verse 3, the master saw the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. What a great model. This officer of Pharaoh is learning the difference between the Egyptians and this one who keeps himself separate and believes in the Lord, because this master uses the covenant name. He knows the covenant name of Israel, of the God of Israel, Yahweh, Jehovah. And he recognizes that is the reason why this young man is so amazing. And it says that Joseph found favor, verse 4, in his sight and served him, and he made him officer of his, overseer of his house. And all that he had, he put under his authority. And it was so from the time that he made him overseer of his house and all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So at first, he's just one of the slaves. The master recognizes, hey, this guy's got some special abilities. He gives him more responsibility. He's faithful. He sees the blessing. Then he puts him in charge of everything. And best thing he could have done, because if he was trying to micromanage Joseph and tell him what to do, he would not have been successful. He just lets Joseph just do whatever. And he was so blessed. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in his house. This is the key here. You know, Potiphar, he's a captain of Pharaoh's bodyguard. He oversaw political executions. He was, in that culture, very likely a eunuch. In fact, I say that because the very word officer comes from a Hebrew word, saras, meaning eunuch. He wasn't just an officer. Being one who was a political appointee, in that culture, in the Egyptian dynasties, there were 31 dynasties in the Egyptian history. The dynasty would be like one who started a lineage, you know, and all of his sons were on the throne until a point came when there was a military coup or an overthrow or something happened, and it would start with another family. Well, the kings, in order to keep their dynasty intact, what they would do is they'd basically take all of the people who were close to them, because they were the ones that could probably do the military coup. They knew all the secrets. They'd castrate them all. And they had to live as eunuchs. But because they had the look of a politician, here, this eunuch was married. Now, you got a feel for his wife in that, obviously. But it also explains another thing of what's going to happen, because Joseph has, with all of his blessing, he's cursed with one thing. And that is incredibly good looks. So, and by the way, if you think that's not a curse, let me say something. People that have all of what the world deems valuable, like wealth, intelligence, beauty, those things people salivate over. This is what they want. And you are a marketable commodity if you have that, but that only brings you into a place of greater temptation. And Joseph, it says that he left everything he had in Joseph's hand and didn't even know what he had except for the bread that he ate. But it says in the end of verse 6, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. He was a good-looking kid. And it says, it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph and said, she became very bold, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what's with me in the house. He's committed all that he has in my hand. There's none greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you were his wife. I want you to underline the next sentence. The last sentence in verse 9. I want you to put stars around it. I want you to circle it. I want you to highlight it, whatever it takes. Because I believe this is the secret here. Because God was with Joseph. God was with Joseph. God was with Joseph. God was with Joseph. 4 times we'll see that repeated. But I believe this was one of the reasons why. Joseph was with God. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? You see how he saw it? I mean, it would have been a political expedient move if he had, you know, got in close with the master's wife. Certainly, she would have kept a secret from her husband. He would have had no problems. Plus, I'm sure she was drop-dead gorgeous, being a political appointed wife. She had to look the part. And she's unfulfilled, and I'm sure the temptation, I mean, I can only imagine how subtle her approach was. It says it. You know, it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day that he didn't heed her to lie with her or to be with her day by day by day. Can you imagine how many little innuendos she must have dropped? How many times she left the bedroom door open slightly while she was getting changed and just to put that temptation in front of him? How hard that must have been. I'm sure that now Joseph has this on his heart. Now, what I love and appreciate about Joseph is that he sees it for what it is. He's a young man. He's got temptations. He has desires. He's not immune to that, but he has a greater passion. See, the only way to overcome a lesser passion is with a greater passion. This is why men stumble. This is why women stumble into sin. Not because they had a passion that was stronger than anybody else's, which is often the excuse. You know, I'm just a hot-blooded man. You know, I've just got these desires. Oh, you're unique. No. What keeps some faithful to their marriages? Is it because of the animal magnetism of their incredible ability? No. Is it because they're not tempted? You know, oh, I'm not tempted. Now, I used to tell the guys when I was in construction and they'd open their little boxes and there'd be pornography all over and they'd come on, Pastor Reverend Lloyd, they'd call me, come on, look. And I'd say, look, you know, when you got a Rolls Royce at home, you don't look at the Volkswagens on the street. But you know, at the same time, I'm a man. And if I indulged myself in that, it would affect me. And you know what it does? And you know, I think what happens is we think we make stupid decisions when we think we're stronger than we really are. The point was that Joseph had a greater passion. How can I sin against God? How can I do this great wickedness? Now, you think about it, you would actually think he would have an excuse. Look what God has done. I've done everything faithful, and he's allowed me to be a slave. He's let me down. God has held out on me. He's let me down. So why should I be faithful to him? It doesn't work that way with Joseph, because you see, he believed God. And he loved God. And it was a greater passion, even than the passions that he had with his body. And you know what? One thing about passion, and this is something, listen, passion comes in waves where you can get struck in a moment. Like you, the Bible says, on the evil day, stand firm. Have you ever noticed some days are more evil than others? Some days you're not even have a problem with lust or didn't even think about it. Other days it's like, wow, from the moment you wake up, it's like just, and then you see something and like your whole like, it's like reverberating in your brain and the passion. There's that pleasure center in the front of your brain. Listen, when you stimulate that, it overrides the cognitive ability, your reasoning. And this is why people that are known, have a good reputation, then all of a sudden do something uncharacteristic of them. Why? Because you know what? They stimulated that pleasure center and it overrode their reasoning ability. What keeps Joseph from being able to do that, I think, is his walk with God, his passion for the Lord. I remember as a young man being put into some very difficult, tempting circumstances when I was over in England doing school. And, you know, it was one of those things where I, you know, one of the girls said, hey, knock on my door, you know, walk to class with you. So I knock on her door and she says, well, come on, I'm not quite ready. And so I come in and she's still in her nightgown. What are you doing? We got to go to class. Oh, I'm just not feeling well. I'm depressed. And I'm like, uh-oh. I mean, as a young man, I knew this was not going to end well. And I immediately said, well, listen, I'm going to go to class. I had to get out of there. I knew if I'd have went in there and shut the door, it's over. And, you know, sometimes you have to use reason. You have to think. You have to put yourself in those positions. And I thank God the Lord has been faithful to keep me. I want to be kept because I also know that David didn't stumble in that area until he was 50. I turned 50 this year and I don't want to be stupid. But I'll tell you what I could be. Any of us could be. But what makes it different for Joseph is that He had that passion for the Lord and he cultivated that. And I believe that kept him. Young men, be warned. Young women, be warned. Listen, Proverbs 5, 7, and 9 are three proverbs that will give you some real good counsel in this area of sexual temptation. Powerful, powerful words. Proverbs 5, verse 3 says, the lips of an immoral woman drip honey and her mouth is smoother than oil. But in the end, she's as bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lay hold of hell. That's pretty powerful language. He says, and you mourn at last when your flesh and body are consumed. And then you say, oh, how I hated instruction. His own iniquities to trap the wicked man. He'll die for lack of instruction. Great counsel in chapter 5. Chapter 7 as well. Well, also chapter 6, there's a verse in 26. He says, by the means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread. That's pretty powerful. An adulteress will prey upon his precious life. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared? So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished, will not be innocent. You know, all the Proverbs 7 speaks about this young man who goes after this really, you know, hot chick there. You know, she's flirting with him. And it says, with her enticing speech, she causes him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. And he goes after her as an ox led to the slaughter, as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare. He did not know it would cost his life. You could almost read sexually transmitted diseases in some of these punishments. And let me tell you, STDs are absolutely off the charts right now. And half of the people that contract them out of the 16 million every year that do are in their teens. It's out of control in our nation right now. And young people, you know, they're only stirring up these passions more and more. I mean, now the big thing is sexting, which is you use your little phones to text messages. Now they're texting pornographic images of themselves or of their girlfriends to their friends. And some of the kids now are under charges because it's child pornography. A guy takes his 13-year-old girlfriend's, you know, picture when she's, you know, not wearing anything and then sends it to his friends texting it. He's passing child pornography. And you know what? They're going to make an example out of these kids that are doing it. And I'll tell you what, as a parent, listen, you can't be naive. I think you have every right and authority to grab that phone from your teen and check what's on that at any given time. And you better know that it's just so available. But listen, we've got to be wise. Now, I love Joseph because, again, I think the power in him, it was the secret of Joseph, wasn't because he was such a great guy. The Lord was with him. But you see, he responded by keeping with the Lord. And I think that's the key. It happened in verse 11. Now, it gets worse for Joseph. It happened about this time when Joseph was in the house to do his work. None of the men of the house were inside, and she caught him by the garment. She grabs him. Now she's bold. Says, lie with me. But you know what? He somehow squirms out of her hands, and he leaves his garment in her hand, and he fled and ran outside. And it was so when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside. Now she's a scorned woman. As much as she desired him and loved him and wanted him, now she's going to ruin him because she doesn't get what she wants. Now, this is human nature here. She called the men of her house and spoke, said, see, this man, he has brought a Hebrew in to mock us, and he came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when he heard, I lifted my voice and cried out. He left his garment with me and fled and went outside. What I do love about Joseph here is he does run. You know, by the way, when you're ever caught in a situation where the only thing you can do is run, then run. Get out of there. So she kept his garment with her, and when his master came home, of course, she gives the same rehearsed speech. You know, in fact, even blames him. The Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came into me to mock me, and it happened. I cried out, and he left his garment with me, and he fled. Nowhere in the record here does it show Joseph defending himself. Now, he may have, but the record records he didn't, and I think that's very important because, like Jesus, and he was falsely accused, but he did not defend himself. He opened not his mouth, the Bible says in Isaiah 53. He was like a lamb led to the slaughter. And it's interesting that Potiphar, Joseph's master, verse 20, took him and put him in prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. When he heard these words, his wife spoke to him. He says, your servant did this to me after this manner. His anger was aroused. It does not say who he was angry with, though you presume reading it, he was angry with Joseph. However, he does something very odd. Being the executioner, he doesn't execute Joseph. He puts him into the political prison, which is kind of like three hots in a cot. You know, he's got everything taken care of there, and the political prisoners would be well treated until their case could be going to court. So in a sense, he gives Joseph a break here, a huge break, because I have a feeling he felt that Joseph was probably innocent. But listen, his hands are tied. He's got a political appointment. He's got a political marriage. He's got appearance to keep up. And, you know, in many ways, this also is kind of a mirror of Pilate's dilemma. Remember when Pilate had Jesus and felt that Jesus was innocent? But what does he end up doing? Hey, the appearance of it, he can't defend Jesus. He has to let him be crucified. And I think Potiphar made that same decision. Here is Joseph, numbered with the transgressors now, thrown into prison, suffering at the hands of the Gentiles, though he's innocent. But verse 21, you got to love it. Let's read it together. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And I love that. Just, but the Lord was with Joseph. If you leave here today with you that one thing, but the Lord was with Joseph, I want you to keep in mind that that same statement was exhorted a king in Judah later on by the name of Asa. The prophet came to Asa and said, the Lord is with you while you are with him. 1 Samuel, the Bible says, God will honor him who honors him. And I think that's the secret for Joseph. I believe there's the reciprocation. God's sovereign. He's got a plan for Joseph's life. And Joseph is responding. And in responding in obedience is not only part of the sovereign plan, but also is personally blessed. Eventually, God is going to work this out. Judah, on the other hand, disobedient, selfish, full of lusts, living like a Canaanite, not honoring God. God is still going to be faithful to fulfill his word through Judah. But he does not enjoy it. How many Christians are, well, they're Christians in name only. They're really not honoring, obedient, following the Lord, really believing him to overcome their temptations. And now listen, more and more our world is becoming like a Canaanite culture where it's more important the genital happiness of a group of people than it is for the next generation. What's going on? Same-sex marriages. Christians are actually defending them. Well, you know, it doesn't really matter if they love each other. Are you thinking about what that will mean to the next generation? Just to appease the political pressure of some who want to live in a certain way that they don't care what this means to the next generation? They haven't even bothered to look at the studies. Our legislature has not even bothered to look at the studies of what happens to children in homes like this. They haven't even looked because it's a mad rush to look very generous and very open-minded. And, well, you know what I say, and I'm sure one day, by saying this, I'll be brought before the authorities. But it's a sin. And you know what? The Lord has a better plan. And you know, I have to say, for people that are struggling with those homosexual temptations, and there are many that are here, and there are some that have come out of that lifestyle and repented and are believing the Lord and trusting Him, and God is honoring them by their honoring Him. And they're escaping those things. And the Lord is strengthening them to do the right thing. And you know what? You talk to them. You can meet them. The Out of Egypt ministry, they're doing a wonderful job. A lot of wonderful people that have you know, been caught up in that lifestyle, now following the Lord, to have a passion to reach others. They have a love, a power. They want others to experience that same power. That's so exciting to me. But don't buy into the Canaanite culture. And I think Joseph, he keeps separate from it, and the Lord honors it, even though now what happens? He's in prison, but the Lord is with him. I think you're going to have to make up your mind somewhere along the line. Are you going to be willing to go to prison if the Lord is with you? Well, the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison didn't look into anything that was under Joseph's authority because the Lord was with him. Whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. You got to love this. The Lord was with Joseph. How he adjusted so quickly to the circumstances. When he's a slave, he's going to be the best slave he can be because he's doing his work unto the Lord. When he's a prisoner, he's going to be the model prisoner because what? He's a prisoner unto the Lord. Even Paul the Apostle, remember when he was put into prison and he'd write his letters and he'd say, "Hey, Paul, a prisoner of the Lord Jesus." Now, picture the Roman authorities who would probably read his letters before they went out. They'd read that, "Paul, a prisoner of Jesus Christ." "He is not. He's a prisoner of Rome." Oh, no, he wasn't. He's only a prisoner in Rome as long as the Lord wants him there. He's truly a prisoner of the Lord Jesus. And I want to submit to you, whatever circumstance you find yourself in, you tend to want to blame the Lord. And you know what? I actually want to agree with you. It is the Lord's doing. If you have made decisions that have brought consequences upon your life that are extremely painful, it is the Lord's doing. He's allowed that to happen. If something tragic has happened in your life through no fault of yours, like Joseph, it is the Lord's doing. But listen, you have not seen the end of the story yet. Don't judge too quickly. If you stopped right here with Joseph's life, there's the end of the story. Man, the guy's faithful to be honoring to his father, and his brothers sell him as a slave. Wow, he's faithful as a slave, and he gets falsely accused. Now he's in prison. Wow, great to follow God, huh? That's how some look at it. Maybe you're looking at it in your own life. But I want to exhort you. The secret with Joseph is the Lord was indeed with him. And the Lord will be with you if you'll trust Him. As Joseph trusted and honored the Lord. And you know, it all comes down to this temptation. And I think this is why Joseph overcomes. He is sorely tempted. Jesus was tempted in every point like we are, yet without sin. And Joseph maintains his integrity and he gives us a model. But I think there's a secret for that. He realizes the cost of yielding. How could I sin against God? That would be the most horrible thing in the world. I think if there's one thing, you could talk about hell. How bad is hell? Hell is bad. How bad is the devil? Oh, he's bad. How bad is sin? Sin is far worse than hell, than death, than the devil, than anything you can think of. Because sin gives power to hell, death, and the devil in your life. If you choose to honor the Lord with your life and to get the forgiveness that comes through Jesus Christ and to walk with Him in His power, which He provides because you can't live how you're supposed to live in your own power, it's an amazing thing. Now hell, devil, and death has no power anymore. So which is worse? If we could learn to hate evil like the Lord has instructed us, it would give us a higher passion. How can I sin against God? And Joseph realizes the cost of temptation or falling, and he resists that temptation to the point of, well, fleeing. The Bible says, flee youthful lust. Joseph literally showed us how to flee. He ran out, even without his coat. And I believe the fourth thing in that, not only resist or realize and resist and run, but renew. See, when you walk in the Spirit, you won't fulfill the lust of the flesh. You could stand there all your life trying to not sin. I'm not going to sin. I'm not going to sin. And you're going to stumble right and left. You can't not sin unless you first submit to God and you yield your life to Him. Then He will give you the power. And you're yielded under His influence. He will give you power that you don't have. Listen, I can't boast in anything in my own life because I haven't done this, 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 or that. It's only by the power of God. I'm afraid of myself. I know what I'm capable of. I know what's in this flesh. And it makes me that much more aware, Lord, help me. And you know what? He helps me day by day. And the temptations come day by day by day. Just as Potiphar's wife was there, it's in our face constantly, guys. It's always there. But you know what? He had a greater passion. I love the model that Jesus leaves for us, and I pray that if anything, this will create in us a desire to get to know the God Joseph knows. A desire to find out, can God do that in my life? Oh, yes, He can. If you're abiding in your own strength and your talent and your ability, it's only a matter of time before you're going to stumble over yourself. But if you've come to know the living God through His Son Jesus and know what He did on the cross for you as He died for you, and He washed all of that sin away, all of your past can be washed as white as snow. He can give you a brand new heart and power to walk in His ways. Do you believe this? If you half believe it, you're only going to half trust Him. And you're only going to have half the strength you need when you face the situations. And then you're going to wonder, well, it doesn't work. But when you trust Him, you make up your mind. And you know what? When that passion hits you like a rock, just know that oftentimes, as hard and strong as it hits you immediately, when you resist it, it dissipates just as quickly. And then you think, wow, what was I even tempted for? Because that's how it comes, in waves, if you trust the Lord.